RadioInfluence.com. The future is now.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this Thursday, May 9th edition of the Landry Football Podcast. We were not here on Tuesday. Some technical difficulties. We think we've got them corrected, although been a major problem for those of you. It's probably no surprise to realize that I'm not the technical guy. Certainly not someone that could handle that. Got people to handle that for us. But just a lot of things that led to some issues. We think we got a problem. I think got somebody that handles my social media. Think we were hacked into by the Facebook. So God knows what's going on there. People asking for ransom for this or that, or we'll send some weird looking, just weird stuff that I know nothing about. But anyway, we'll see if we've got it all corrected. We were unable to do the podcast on Tuesday, and we are looking into some interesting possibilities. We've got a lot of things going on at LandryFootball.com. We're considering maybe just doing this podcast every Tuesday or continuing on Tuesday and Thursday, time committing. We'll keep you updated on that. But it was the plan to do a podcast on Tuesday. But if we're having some computer issues and could not get it to the people that it needed to so that it gets to you, occasionally those things take place. Glad it wasn't in the middle draft preparation of the season. But anyway, we're back today. I remind you, at LandryFootball.com, we're working hard to keep you up to date on all the information, college football notebooks, latest in recruiting. May's a big recruiting month, and a lot of information there, evaluation of players, breaking down rosters, grinding through the tape, and giving assessments of college rosters, and working to do the same with NFL rosters. So that's where you want to be. It's a great opportunity. I know you think, it's football season. We'll wait. Folks, there'll be so much information by the time football season gets here. It'll be overwhelming for you. So take advantage of it now. Join us today. You will get breakdowns of all these programs, not just the generic, stuff that you read in magazines. We're talking about scouting breakdowns of college rosters, NFL rosters that'll get you ready for the football season unlike ever before. We've got some good questions we're going to address to today as well, some holdovers that we're going to get to on Tuesday. But we want to talk about a couple of things. We're going to try to streamline things a little bit better. I have a tendency to go on, and I don't know. Maybe that's good, probably not good. But want to talk about a couple of things. One involving NFL players and the issues of them showing up or not showing up for voluntary camps. And I want to bring a little perspective to you and maybe bring both sides and understand it. Okay, of course, with the collective bargaining agreement, which everything to do with NFL organizations and NFL players is collectively bargained. So, there's regulations about, when it's a mandatory camp, you're subject to fines if you don't show up by the team. Voluntary camp is just that, voluntary camp. Don't need to be there. We're living in an age where players tend to do their own thing with their own trainers. Like to train in Miami and not be in Chicago or wherever. We understand that. And so they're within their right to do that. But we've kind of gone, I think, the other way in sports to where, and it's certainly more in other sports than in football, but it is becoming increasingly more prevalent in football where, the players tend to call the shots and decide what they're going to do. And it is certainly not the way I was raised in the sport of football. And football is the ultimate team game. it really came out, and it's not about Le'Veon Bell specifically, but it is the reason why I want to bring it up, because it's the latest one that's taken place. Okay, guy like Le'Veon Bell sat out last year. He didn't sign his tender. Sat out, didn't make any money. Betting on himself, signed a new deal with the Jets. Not showing up for voluntary camp. Well, that used to be a big deal. It's not a big deal anymore. Hey, it doesn't matter. He's going to be ready. He's going to play well. You know, look what he's going to do during the season, and that's all that matters. You don't need this. You don't need that. You don't need practice. You don't need camps. You don't need to do this. Hey, you can do your own thing. Much ado about nothing. So says the media. So says a lot of fans who just sit there and consume the game on television or in person and don't really understand what goes on behind the scenes in preparation for said games and seasons. Look, voluntary camps are voluntary. You don't need to come. It's voluntary. But voluntary camps, by and large, if you're going to be really good as a team, should be attended by everybody. These guys make a lot of money. They're given stipends for these camps. They're fed. There are a lot of these things that are done. A player himself, let's take Le'Veon Bell, may be doing the best thing he needs to do to get his body ready for the season. So be it. If he feels like it's better to do it his way and it's proven successful, so be it. It's not about just how well he's going to play during the season. This is a team game. Showing up for voluntary camps are important. People say, well, if it was important, they'd make it mandatory. Well, no, that's part of it being collectively bargained. And the reality is, I don't know, you in negotiations, you're willing to give up certain things. You're willing to, you know, stand firm on certain things. This is not about a collective bargaining agreement in totality. It is about what do you want to do to help your teammates to make them better. I'm sure you read and hear about quarterbacks who call up their receivers and say, hey, we're going to meet at such and such a place, usually a resort area. Excuse me. I'm going to put you guys up. We're going to eat. We're going to bond. We're going to go to dinner. We're going to, you know, spend time. And we're going to work out during the day, and we're going to work on route concepts and different things that are going to allow our timing to be enhanced so that we don't miss a beat. We're going full speed once we do show up for our camps. Those things are really important, and people who do those things are ahead of the game. Those are further down the line from the voluntary camps. Ideally, as a coach, as a personnel guy, as an administrator overseeing an NFL team, it is really important for us to have all players engaged. And even if physically they want to do their own thing with their trainer, which that's a different topic for a different day, at least if you show up, you may not need extra work, although everybody needs extra work in the film room, particularly when you go on with a new team. But more than you benefiting, your coaches and your other players will benefit. So let's take Le'Veon Bell. He's going to a new team, a new young quarterback, new coaching staff. He doesn't have a real feel for them, and they don't have a real feel for him in terms of how to coach him, how things are going to go. The advantage of having a player like that in voluntary camp is that you can be in a room and you can aid other young players. How to look at film. This is how I do it. This is what this means. Add some things. You know, in Pittsburgh, we did certain things here, there. Those things are really helpful from a coaching staff, some feedback of maybe how we call something, maybe how we do something. All those things are really valuable in our mental, they're preparatory towards practice, and they're very useful. And it should be something that's embraced. You got a lot of time for vacation. You got a lot of time to get off. You've got to keep yourself in physical shape, but you need to keep yourself in good mental shape. And if you're at the point where you've played in this league a long time and you've constantly prepared yourself well and you've always been really reliable and you've given no reason for anybody to question your team first attitude, which all those things do not apply to Le'Veon Bell. There's a lot of people that question, you know, his work ethic, and that's why he's had a lot of injuries in the past. And let's just call it what it is. He didn't want to be at minicamp. Jets gave him money. He got what he wanted, and he's going to do it his way and to hell with anybody else. But even the guy that I take, a guy like Bruce Matthews, who I coached. Bruce Matthews, towards the end of his career, we didn't put him through the rigors physically of minicamp. We limited his practices in training camp. But Bruce was always prepared, and Bruce always showed up at voluntary camps. You know why? Because his presence showed the importance of it. He was able to help young players. He was just little things, how to deal with certain things as a player that is on and off the field, how to better understand what the coach is teaching you, how to give feedback from a player standpoint, bonding with the player, all those things, being a leader. Everybody can be a leader in their own way. Some guys are vocal leaders, but even if you're not a leader, being a good teammate, being engaged with your teammates, just being there is important. You're not going to have everybody show up. I get it. But building a culture is really important. And getting guys to have a keen understanding of roles, way to get better, how to do things together as a team, a lot of what you do is going to benefit. Even playing around a golf together with guys or a fishing trip or what have you. Even boys will be boys, kind of, you know, goofy stuff. It's all camaraderie building, and you understand someone's personality. You understand how to communicate better with them, and you understand how to work with them better. And this is what it is. And this is what's important. This is what's missing when you don't get there. And so when you hear people that say, oh, it's not important, it doesn't matter, again, you're dealing with people that don't know, that have no clue because they've never been a part of any of these things, and they don't know what's important or not because they've never been a part of building that. So I think it's important, and it's not just, again, a Le'Veon Bell situation. Other players in the same situation. But I thought it was important to understand that it's bigger than the player. It's bigger than, well, he's going to play well. So what's the narrative going to be? Let's say the Jets have a really good season next year, and Le'Veon Bell's a big part of it. Well, you see, Chris, it doesn't matter. No, it does matter. Because maybe it could have even been better. Maybe you could have helped another player on your team get better. Maybe as good as a season you had, maybe you would have been a little bit better. The fact that, oh, he had a good season, this doesn't matter. He had a bad season, this is why, is totally misunderstood. And we're in a results-oriented society. And results are what matters. But in order to achieve the right result, you have to understand the process, understand what creates the result. That's the thing that people that are on the outside don't get. The result doesn't happen. The result is just that, the result of what you do. And if you have a certain level of success, meaning your record is really good, your stats are really good, well, then everything you did was right. No, that's not correct. What can you do to get even better? This is what makes, you know, the guys like the Tom Brady's or the Peyton Manning's, and a lot of them stick around longer. Because as good as they've been, they're doing extra things to get better. They're doing extra things to help their team. Now, Tom Brady is not going to some of the voluntary camps. Oh, Chris, that's bad. Well, I think it'd be great if he was there too. He's at the stage where they have a plan. The other quarterbacks will get timing and rhythm with it, but he will also reach out to these players and try to help them. And so I'm not going to let this go and say it's okay for Tom Brady to skip and not okay for Le'Veon Bell. No. I think as great as Tom Brady's been, I think being there at minicamp would enhance things. It says, can you imagine if Tom Brady shows up? It makes it even all the more important for the young player to realize, and the young player has to realize he's not the same guy as the future Hall of Famer. But when that future Hall of Famer shows up, that All-Pro shows up, man, it just enhances the importance of what we're doing. And heightened intensity in preparation leads to better success on the field. So, again, is it going to destroy a team? Is it going to make a team, break a team? What it does is all the little things in the preparation, all the little things that are done in the off-season conditioning programs in college, all the little things that are done in the NFL to prepare for camp, to with all the roster changes every year with free agency, guys moving in and out, of course, the draft class every year adds certain people into the mix. Continuity puts you ahead of the game. It doesn't guarantee you success because if you're not talented enough, you still might not achieve what you had hoped. But the importance of being present, being a part of it in meetings, being around practice, even if you're recovering from an injury, even if you're rehabbing, even if you're training, good. Maybe do the training at the facility and maybe it'll benefit some young players. It is something that in the team game is not explained enough. It's not respected enough. And I think it's just more than the old coach in me saying more emphasis should be put on it. I know that not everybody lives and breathes football like I do, but I think an enhanced desire to be great in your football acumen is the key to being successful, and it is the key in any form of business. I want to move on to tell you what's going on this time of year. People often ask me, and this is a good time to address it. Okay, the draft is done. Take me through the draft process, Chris. You know, people ask me that prior to the draft. Well, this is the time to start talking about the draft. In a couple of weeks, I'll be attending May meetings for the scouting combines. And let me explain that. No. Not the Indianapolis scouting combine. What we call the scouting combine is technically the National Invitational Camp, where guys work out in February. You all know that. What I think you know by now by listening to me is there are two scouting organizations for the NFL. BLESTO, which stands for or stood for Bears, Lions, Eagles, Steelers, Talent Organization. Then the Vikings came in and joined. It was BLESTO 5 and BLESTO V, and they stopped changing the name every time. They just call it BLESTO, and there are a lot of teams. The Dolphins are in it, whatnot. And then you've got National Football Scouting. Those are two organizations that the NFL belongs to. The NFL teams hire a scout and designates them as their national scout, or meaning the National Combine Scout, or the BLESTO Scout. The team pays them their salary. Team pays them the benefits. And what is done is they're responsible for an area of the country, which is broken down into 12 areas. And the information, the reports that they write, which is background and nature and a lot of basic data that are important in the scouting world and film review, is shared with all the other teams in the scouting organization. So this is not what the teams think of a player, but it's what the scouting organizations believe in the beginning process of breaking down players. Now, all spring, while everybody was preparing for the draft, these combine scouts, national scouts, and when I say national, I don't mean just going nationally. I'm talking about National Football Scouting scouts and BLESTO scouts working for the teams. They go out and they're working on the 2020 draft class, meaning they're going to every school in their area in the spring. They go to spring practice. They have what is called a spring day for underclassmen, which they time every player. And they usually get not only just the senior, upcoming seniors, but upcoming juniors, guys that were sophomores. So they getting height, weights, and speed at the school and other agility information pursuant to scouting evaluations, the initial stuff. And the scout is responsible for looking at tape, at least 4 or 5 games from last year. They write a report on a player, and those are correlated and organized. And in late May, we get together for these meetings, and the scouts read their report by region, and all the team scouts, all the team scouting directors, representatives from each teams are there. They get the reports, and they get to listen to the reports. This is the foundation for the initial scouting list, the checklist, if you will, heading into the fall. So coming out of this meeting, there's a list of every school in the country, broken down by different areas, that have a prospect. They list, first of all, every guy who's got a potential make it grade, the guy that's considered potentially draftable or worthy of bringing into the camp. And then they have the list of every other player on the roster that would be draft eligible, and they would be kind of on the reject list. But you have the verified numbers, and that information is put together. So it is taken back each team. Each team's scouting director takes that information, and they begin to help the scouts formulate their scouting schedule for the fall. So there are two things that are done. Scouts are responsible for looking at a certain amount of film on tape this time of year, May, June, July, prior to coming to camp. And based upon that, they have a feel for the players in their area. So, for example, if you are in North Carolina, well, you're going to go to North Carolina, North Carolina State, Duke, Wake Forest, East Carolina. It goes like that every year. But you might not go to Gardner-Webb every year. If there is somebody that is worth at least checking out, you'll put Gardner-Webb on your list, and you'll stop by Gardner-Webb. If everyone's listed as a reject, you don't need to put your Gardner-Webb, you know, on your schedule that year. And you make your schedule, and you've looked at film, and now when you go to camp, a scout's responsibilities during camp, in mini camp, in regular training camp, is to evaluate your own team's roster. And then once preseason starts, you're responsible for evaluating, along with the pro personnel staff, other teams' rosters, particularly guys that you think another team might release. Guys like that, you can then bring and add to your roster to improve your roster. But they also, in addition to doing that, they're making their schedules and fine-tuning where they're going to go in the fall. Late August, after preseason begins to get done, then the area scouts are out scouting their region, their area. And they're going to schools. They're, you know, in the early part of the schedule, you're going to practice. There are obviously no games yet, so you're doing a lot of groundwork. You go a school that you go to in August, you're probably going to circle around and go back somewhat early November where there are more games in the mix. But the process is you start out probably with as many as 5,000 names off that list. And you whittle it down pretty quickly to about 1,500. And then, based upon your region, you go into your areas. And quickly, based upon when you come out of it, that's where you come out with about 500 names, which is whittled down to about 300. And then, as I've explained through the draft process, you whittle that down to the guys that fit you and guys that go to the All-Star Games and Combine that you evaluate. You whittle your list down to a lot less. But it starts with a bigger number, because you need to look at it. And so this is the process, and I wanted to bring it out because the process, well, has already started with the Combine Scouts, but it starts for the teams truly after these Combine meetings where they truly know who is on the list, who they need to check out, and how that's going to play out. Now, they also are familiar with players in their school that, all right, this school's got a really good, you know, if you're at Colorado and you're scouting the Colorado class last year, you know about Laviska Shenault, who's going to be probably an early entry for the 2020 draft. You already know about him because you know that school. You know, but there are, you also know about other guys. So you combine whatever notes you might have made on underclassmen with the background information and the intel of that you get from the combine scout, and then you're off and running with beginning the process of evaluating each player in your school and making sure you got things covered. Sometimes players rise up that are not on the initial list. You add those guys on the list, and you somebody gets in there, looks at them, and evaluates them. We always have a rule. If a guy has any chance, has anything going on whatsoever, got anything going for him, put him on the list. We can kill him later. Just put him on the list, and we'll see. So that's kind of how the initial list works in the scouting world. Before I get to some questions, I want to mention something that I think's interesting. We are in this post-draft era of free agency where you're looking at who's available and what are the options to maybe add to fill out your roster. We need another defensive lineman, don't we all? Everyone seems to. We need to add another offensive lineman in camp. And that'd be good enough to make the team, but we don't know. We want to compete. We need to add another kicker. If nothing else, just a kick. We need to add another camp arm because the main starters can't throw every pass and every kicker can't kick every kick. Their leg's going to be dead. Their arm's going to be dead. So you want to add all those spots. But then there's some guys like maybe a Ziggy Ansah that has some ability, maybe we'll sign somewhere else. And we'll definitely sign somewhere else. He's probably close to getting a deal done with Seattle as we speak. But there is something that may not be aware of that I want to bring out that I think you're aware a little bit of how compensatory selection process works. When you sign a free agent and you lose a free agent, those are weighted against one another. So it takes all the players that you sign and it takes all the players that you lose. And it's a weighted scale that determines whether you get compensatory selections, how many, and where they're going to be. It's a very nebulous formula, but that's how it's predicated and determined. This week is the last week where the signing of free agent is going to count against your compensatory selections next year. So anybody that signs is not going to count against you adding a player. So this is why you're going to see a few players like Ziggy Ansah and others being signed in the next few weeks because they're not going to count against your compensatory selection balance sheet. So little tricks of the trade that you know, kind of like when you finish the start of putting your roster, if you put a vested veteran on your opening day roster, his salary is guaranteed for the year, which is why sometimes you see veterans get released and then sign after the first week and people are confused. Well, the reason is they think the guy may have something left, but they're kind of doubting it. So they don't want to get on the hook for paying his salary for the entire year. So he's not on the opening day roster. He's on the roster starting the second week, which means that if week five, somebody else, a younger guy, is playing better, they can release the veteran and not have to pay his salary and not have it count against their cap. Important little tricks of the trade in personnel. All right, Kevin says, when I read or hear in the news that a top recruit decommits and decides on a different university, generally speaking, is it just a change of heart or is there usually some type of post-committal tampering taking place? Kevin, what has changed over the years is that the offers are going out sooner. It used to be that you never offered a kid a scholarship until midway through his senior year. So you were pretty sure that you wanted that kid, and they pretty much, once they committed, knew where they wanted to go. Well, today they're offering kids and freshmen and sophomores in high school. Well, it's too early. You have to do it because that's what everybody's doing, and if you're not on par with offering them early, you're not going to have a chance to get them. But here's what happens. You're offering a guy early, and he's committing to you early. What happens when they become juniors and then into their senior year, all of a sudden you like some players better. You might back off that offer. Or they may like another school better. Maybe there's plenty enough time for coaching changes. All of a sudden, one school that they weren't high on, they're now high on, and vice versa. So because of the early nature of offers and commitments, it's going to lead to guys backing out of commitments and schools backing out of commitments. So it is a process of just being too early in the process. And when I say too early, the earlier you do it, the more variables you're going to have to change your mind. I mean, it's common sense. If I say, hey, Kevin, let's go play golf, you know, 2 months from today. I mean, you don't really know what the heck's going on 2 months from today, and it may sound great today, but you don't, you know, 3 or 4 days before something comes up. If I say, let's go play golf today, you pretty much know what you're going to do. You know what the weather's going to be like. You know what's going on. So you can say yay or nay. It's too far down the road to have as strong of a commitment that you normally like. So that's a part of it. Yeah, there are tampering that take place as well, you ask. Of course, a kid is committed to a school. Other schools continue to recruit them, continue to change your mind. Well, again, you don't know what's going to happen to that school. They may lose their coach, move on, things happen. So yes, usually you didn't recruit a player once he committed to a school. Now you recruit a player even after he commits. So that is, if you want to call it tampering, that's exactly what happens. You also asked in last Tuesday's podcast, you mentioned that the great Bobby Beathard misevaluating Ryan Leaf. He wasn't the only one. A lot of people did. And certainly people in the media thought everybody was foolish that to thinking that Peyton Manning was better. Everybody in the media thought Ryan Leaf was better. And, oh, Peyton Manning, if his name was just, you know, Peyton Marshall, he wouldn't be anything. And after his rookie year, you know who had the better year? Ryan Leaf. Again. This is why when you start ranking these drafts that these people do it silly and it's ignorant. Yes, why was the evaluation so puzzling for people who knew how to evaluate? Very simple. Sometimes you don't know enough about the person as much as you try. That's why we do all these psychological testings. Ryan Leaf, to really know Ryan Leaf's problem, if you went to Washington State, Mike Price swore by him. That staff swore by him. The greatest kid, never had a problem, yada, yada, yada. The people who did their homework and spent time in Montana with his high school coach, knew that there were some issues. Did I think or anybody else think it would be as bad as it did and he ended up in jail and all that? No, of course not. I don't think he can ever forecast that. But there were some signs. But there were signs you had to turn over a lot of rocks to figure out. Anytime you have human beings evaluating human beings, even the best of them will make mistakes. Well, 2006 draft, what was your real-time opinion of Reggie Bush and Mario Williams? Was it splitting hairs on deciding who should be number one, or was there a real gap in the evaluation grades? No, there wasn't a real gap. There was I had the same grade on them, and I had them stacked. The Texans had Mario Williams stacked, Mario Williams, Reggie Bush. I thought Reggie was a little better. Quite frankly, Reggie didn't have the career I thought he would, but he still had a decent career. Mario Williams had a pretty good career. Neither one of them graded out as well as I thought they would, but I wasn't far off in my evaluation. It wasn't. I had a higher grade on them in college than I graded them in the NFL. They didn't play quite as well as I thought. Richard asks, what was your evaluation of Sean Merriman out of Maryland? Loved him. Remember, he came out in the same year as DeMarcus Ware out of Troy. And that was the debate. Ware was a little bit more explosive. Merriman was a little bit stronger at the point of attack. I would say that Ware had a little bit better career, but Merriman had a really good one. I remember exactly what I had. Had a 6.5 grade on him, on both, and had Ware stacked ahead, but liked them both. And listen, there was a lot of criticism of Dallas by media that they took the wrong guy. They should have took Merriman ahead of Ware. I don't think that's correct. I think they took the right guy, but, you know, Merriman was outstanding in his own right. You also asked, what was your assessment of Richard Bisaccia as his coach? I think he's an outstanding special teams coach. Outstanding. Done for a long time and done it very well. What was your assessment of A.J. Smith as a general manager? Again, outstanding. Known A.J. for years, good evaluator, grew up in the Buffalo system. Under John Butler, under Bill Polian, did a great job for them. Was pro personnel director for a while, went to San Diego as the assistant general manager for John Butler. John Butler was the guy that drafted, that traded the first pick to Atlanta. Atlanta came up and took Michael Vick, and it was John Butler with A.J. Smith as his right-hand man that took LaDainian Tomlinson with their pick, and with the top of the second round pick, took Drew Brees. That's not all he did, but that's maybe one of the more famous things. They certainly did a great job in Buffalo, and quite frankly, were the real keys, as was Dom Neely in Carolina and Indianapolis, for Bill Polian's success. Really, really good. They were even better than Bill, and I have a lot of respect for Bill. A.J.'s outstanding. A.J.'s doing some consulting for the Redskins. His son is a young guy that I think they've contributed in helping out Washington as Doug Williams is not the guy there that really is. He's more of a figurehead, and those guys really kind of help him behind the scenes. And I think they've done a pretty good job in the draft, although they've got a lot of interference from the owner, Bruce Allen, which quite frankly hasn't it's really hurt their operation, but those guys are very good. Greg asks, was Michael Brooks. Michael Brooks was a linebacker at LSU in the 80s, played the NFL. Was Michael Brooks as highly rated linebacker as Cornelius Bennett before he hurt his knee? No, but he was close. Michael Brooks, I coached, and was special. Cornelius Bennett was stronger. Michael Bennett was every bit as explosive. He made plays in space every bit as good, and he had a good career in the NFL, but he didn't have as good because of the knee, tore up his knee. But Biscuit, as we call Cornelius Bennett, was the better player. Boy, he was a force. And we'll never know how good Michael could have been, and perhaps he could have been closer to Bennett. So I can't honestly answer it, but in terms of a more complete player, when they both were completely healthy, Bennett was better. Now, clearly Bennett had a much better career, and I think the wideness of gap had to do with the fact that Michael was not healthy, and that was a problem. Greg also asks, how would you rate Jim Fanks as a general manager? Boy, outstanding. A true Hall of Famer. We're talking about a guy that was as good a football administrator as we've ever had in the NFL, in football, in pro football. First of all, he was successful general manager in the Canadian Football League. With Winnipeg, he hired Bud Grant. He was the general manager in Minnesota who brought Bud Grant to the Vikings. And he was a big part of putting the infrastructure in place for the Viking success and all the Purple People Eaters, Tarkenton, and all that group. He was just outstanding. He goes to Chicago. And it was him with Bill Tobin underneath him and guys like that that they began to build that championship Great Bears teams of the 80s and Ditka and all that. Then he goes to the Saints, and he turned that Moribund franchise into a very positive way, hiring Jim Mora and the crew there. So Jim was just unbelievable. Jim finished second to Paul Tagliabue for the commissioner role. He would have been a great commissioner of the NFL. The football people and the old guard wanted Jim Finks. The new guard wanted a lawyer, and that's where they went with Tagliabue. And Tags did a nice job. Jim Finks is as good as it gets. God rest his soul. Was a big-time smoker. Contributed probably to his cancer issues, but just unbelievable, just tremendous. Absolutely tremendous football guy, tremendous football administrator. Jacob asks, you said in the past that John Gruden has trouble with young player development. I noticed that the huge turnover in that roster between free agents and all the draft picks. Do you think his staff can compensate for Gruden's shortcomings in player development? I hope that it can. I hope the fact that he had some time out in football and coaching to study a lot of the things that you can do better to develop young players, I hope those two things can help them become better at doing that, because that was a real struggle with him in Tampa. So that's to be answered going forward, honestly. I think there's potential there, but John's going to have to be, you know, more patient and understand that sometimes doing less is more, and then building off of that. And I think if you can learn that, you've got a much better chance of being successful. All right, thank you for the questions. If you've got any questions, send it to us here at LandryFootball.com. Hit contact Chris, and we will get it done here. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll be keeping you up to date on everything, continuing our football work. There's no off season for us. So check us out at LandryFootball.com. Check out what we've got going there. We've got a number of things going on, the websites, the podcasts, and the posts, and everything. So check us out at LandryFootball.com for all the latest. Talk to you next time, everybody.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
This is a Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
In Philadelphia, the district attorney there, Larry Kirshner, so he was on HBO recently and he talked about implementing a policy in Philadelphia where drug users would, drug possession, if you will, would, they would not be arrested, but more diverted to a diversion program, a drug program, instead of being arrested and having a criminal record. Now, someone asked, was this a political move? I would say yes, but I'll get to that in a minute. But here's what I will say about this policy. In theory, you know, if you go back to the 90s and the Clinton administration, you know, and their tough on crime laws that led to mass incarcerations of prisons. And most of those people that are still in prison 20 something years later because of simple drug possession violations. Is that something I agree with? Absolutely not, because that should be reserved for people who rape, who kill, who sexually assault children, things of that nature. Should you be in jail for life for that stuff? Absolutely. But should you be in prison for 30 years for simple possession of marijuana or cocaine? Absolutely not. But to say that, all right, we're not going to arrest you, we're not going to send you to jail, we're just going to let you go to this drug rehab, this diversion program, to me, that's not the answer. And here's why I say I don't think it's the answer. The problem is when you give someone who has a problem, an addiction, the freedom to not be controlled, guess what? They're going to go to what controls them, the narcotic, the crack cocaine, the heroin, the meth.
Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.